This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome back to the New Books Network. My name is Adam Bobek, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Jonas Tinius back to the show. Jonas is a sociocultural anthropologist and currently a scientific coordinator and postdoctoral researcher in cultural anthropology in the European Research Council project, Minor Universality, based at Saarland University. He studied and received his PhD in social anthropology from the University of Cambridge, and he's currently completing his habilitation and teaching at the Humboldt University, where he is a research fellow at the Center for Anthropological Research on Museums and Heritage, during which he published Across Anthropology and Awkward Archives with Margarete von Oswald, and you can hear our conversations about both of those books here on the New Books Network. Today, we are talking about his new book, State of the Arts, An Ethnography of German Theater and Migration, published in 2023 with Cambridge University Press. Dr. Tinius, welcome to the show.
Thank you for the invitation. It's great to be back.
What inspired you to write this book?
I guess multiple things got me to writing this. Of course, on the one hand, there is the fact that it's grew out of research that I did over several years at the University of Cambridge in social anthropology. But from another point of view, I was particularly interested in understanding the ways in which anthropology and theater could come back together. I had been reading a lot of works that really deeply inspired me, from Richard Schechner to Victor Turner and Laila Abu-Lugod and other ethnographies, I suppose, of performance cultures, many of which drew on this tradition of performance studies, which had, for perhaps two decades, been bringing together anthropology and performance and theater work. But I felt that there was a distinct lack of long-term ethnographic work on contemporary professional theater fields, and especially theater fields that were not freelance performing arts, project-based fields, but traditions, institutionalized traditions. And so I wanted to somehow close that gap a little bit and produce a book that would cover both a particular tradition of theater production and show what anthropology can bring to the table, both in terms of its methods, but also in terms of its theories. Besides that, of course, I also thought that there was a, you know, there's an interesting tradition of a dialogue between theater and anthropology, theater and performance studies and anthropology, but that many things had developed over the last 20, 30 years from multimodal collaborative methods of working together within the field of theater and performance production, especially within the German context and perhaps a sort of, you know, contemporary theater scene. Most interestingly to me, a sort of, you know, an added theoretical reflexivity that whilst previously was already existing had now come onto the stage. So, you know, of the last 10, 15 years, I've been watching so many plays in which theories of how we live together, theories of society, anthropological theories, philosophy, had actually come on stage. And I really thought that that was fascinating and I wanted to deal with it. Those are some of the aspects. Of course, there are others, more personal ones, like the fact that this is actually a theater. The theater case study at the heart of this book is from the city in which I grew up in. It's located on the borders to other cities that are very important to me in terms of my own life. I was born in Oberhausen, which borders Mülheim an der Ruhr. My father was a very committed, engaged high school teacher in these cities and worked a lot with theaters as alternative pedagogic fora, you could say, or at least as fora that reflect on how to teach, let's put it that way. So yeah, these are some of the reasons why I wanted to write this book.
And what audience did you have in mind?
Given that this is an academic book, of course, I had in mind, I suppose, three, let's say, more academic audiences primarily. So I was very interested in writing for scholars in theater and performance theory, also theater historians. In fact, the series editor, Tracy Davis, is for me one of the most inspiring theater historians who's been working so much on theories of theater and performance that have inspired me to write this book. Then, of course, anthropologists working on culture, on institutions, on art. And the third strand of researchers, which is kind of an interesting audience, I suppose, or an interesting dialogue partner for me, being German, having done this ethnography on Germany, but from abroad, is the field of German studies. And by that, I sort of mean especially the way in which German literature and culture has been studied and talked about in the UK, but more so in the US, which, of course, doesn't make any sense in the German context. There is no such thing as German studies in Germany. There is an interesting colonial, post-colonial interest in Germanophone culture, of course, in Cameroon, for instance. I'm thinking about the work of Albert Boisfort and others. But these are the three sort of academic audiences I had in mind, theater, anthropology, and German studies. But then, of course, with subfields, you know, people working on organizational ethnographies, on questions of nation building, on migration, scholars that are deliberately doing, I suppose you could say, decolonizing work, you know, that reflects on the deeply ingrained normative ideas about what a nation is and how migration thinks about this or troubles these ideas. But obviously, as usual, some of the most exciting conversations take place exactly in between, in the interstices. And this book, in fact, for the publisher is sort of labeled as a crossover book in some ways, which I guess means that it speaks to at least two different fields with their own traditions, their own theories and methods. And because of that, I get messages from people that are interested in ethnography from music. I get messages from people that are interested in an aspect of German history or even from, you know, people studying theology and religious histories because they've been looking at the Oberammergauer Festspiele, you know, and we're trying to understand how this theatrical tradition could fit in this landscape. Italian studies, because the founder of the theater at the heart of this book moved to Germany from Italy. Philosophy. So these are all kind of different fields that I want to speak to and that I'm very interested in having a conversation with. And of course, last but not least, the practitioners. You know, I wrote this book, I think, to quite some extent with the actors, the directors, the dramaturgs, but also the young actors and actresses within theaters in Germany who don't necessarily become actors or directors, but who would then go on to study, you know, theater studies or do something else or work in cultural organizations. So to some extent, this is also a book that documents a particular moment in time, that documents a particular place. And, you know, it's not romanticizing a little, you know, locality so that the local bookshop can have it on their shelf. But I also wrote it for these people to some extent. And in fact, one of the first launches of a book on Roberto Trulli was in a very small bookshop that at the time this theater existed was very important. So yeah, those are some of the audiences I had in mind.
And you've touched on this a little bit. Can you introduce listeners more to Theater an der Ruhr and what led you to do field work there?
Absolutely. The Theater an der Ruhr is an interesting institution. I would almost go as far as saying it's either unique or perhaps could be seen in comparison with or in juxtaposition to two or three slightly different institutions. You know, the work of Pina Bausch in Wuppertal, for instance, or the work of Frank Hastorf, the Volksbühne in Berlin. But these organizations that Pina Bausch and Frank Hastorf were related to are very interested, very different in their organizational setup. So one of the first chapters in the book actually deals with the specific institutional development of the Theater an der Ruhr, partly because the three founders, three artists, philosophers, thinkers, Roberto Trulli, a philosopher who had migrated from Milan, where he had founded a tenth theater, had studied philosophy, had tragically had a heart attack at a very young age, and he became sort of a guest worker and tried to work his way up the ranks in Germany. And he founded this theater together with Helmut Schäfer, who is a philosopher, very much steeped in a critical tradition of thinking, a dramaturg in the old school sense, I would say now, but we can talk about that a little bit later. And then the late Ralph Edzard Haben, who was a stage designer and had actually worked with Pina Bausch. So the three of them, already interesting as a sort of artistic intellectual trio, decided to negotiate with this middle-sized Ruhrgebiet city, Mühlheim an der Ruhr, not to become the city theater. They didn't want to become yet another public institution that was fully under the control and public authority of the politicians in the city. But they created what I guess you could call a private-public partnership. That is to say, the three founders became principal shareholders, I suppose. That's not really the right word, but they were liable for this institution. They borrowed a lot of money. I'm not going to go into some of these details. I discuss it in the book, but it was an interesting diplomatic moment in which they created an institution that that would allow a different kind of artistic production. This was hotly contested at the time because it implied, for instance, for them that they wouldn't be part of the trade unions, because they said, listen, the way in which we work in this institution is going to be different. We're going to be traveling a lot. We have a different idea for rehearsals. We don't want to produce 10 plays a year, but maybe two. The way in which we're going to work is not going to be a 9-to-5. This is a political proposal. This is maybe even a kind of, utopian prefiguration of how art could be. I mean, they saw themselves as an avant-garde theater that really wanted to, bring the reflection of modernity and late modernity into theater. They felt that it was their task to translate a lot of different discourses. Anyway, that's in terms of the setup. So it was already a kind of a thorn in the flesh of the German public theater landscape on the one hand. Then, on top of that, it was complicated in other ways too, because the city, though at first giving them a sort of public stage in the center of town by the Ruhr, by the river, they then moved about 10 years later into an old workers' spa in a now very beautifully, reforested, redone park, which gives you the impression of being in quite a genteel neighborhood. But at the same time, you just have to go less than a mile further down the road and you find yourself on the so-called Ruhrotter Straße, which is a long street that connects the industrial harbor of Mülheim with those of Duisburg and Oberhausen, three now post-industrial cities that saw and witnessed a huge amount of industrial traffic through these canals and rivers. And these give you quite a different impression of this part of the Ruhr Valley. So it's an interesting place full of contradictions, full of specters, full of ghosts. because it turned into a hotel at some point, and then they took it off and worked on it and really lived in this house. I mean, it's truly has a place right above, you know, below the roof, and he's been there for the last 45 years. This ensemble has stayed together in many ways for over 30 years. These are, I think, some of the aspects of the Theater Nouveau that fascinated me, besides the fact that they, right from the beginning, perhaps due to Julie's, I suppose, migrant experience, developed a very distinct theater philosophy. I will actually call it that because the dramaturg has written extensively in very thought-provoking and essays on this, a theatre philosophy that tries to work through the development of modern arts, but also at the same time tries to go back to some of the, I suppose, archetypal ideas of theatre as one of the first arts that deals with the question of life and death, with the question of authenticity, with the question of life on stage, whether actors are doing a sort of as if, you know, the classic Platonic accusation, or whether in fact it is an example of an enactment of life lived twice. And then the last element that really, really was so relevant for me as an anthropologist was that this theater said right from the beginning it was a theater for the bastard, for the bastardo in Julie's broken Italo-German, a theater for those that didn't feel at home in Germany, those that didn't feel at home somewhere else, those that had to flee, those that didn't feel like they had a mother tongue that they could relate to. And of course, now we think that this might refer specifically to refugees, which it did too, because in the 1980s, the Ruhr Valley hosted many refugees from the Yugoslav wars. But it also referred to people like my father, and I really have to say this because this book is in some great part actually a study of this particular generation of engaged teachers and pedagogues like my father. It was also, a post-national, or at least it was an attempt to be critical of, you know, ideas of Leitkultur and belonging and integration, because it also deliberately meant those that didn't feel at ease with the politics of their own country. So this is perhaps, that gives you perhaps a little bit of an impression of the Theater Nouveau.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Could you maybe here talk a little bit more about the Ruhrgebiet generally?
Yes, with pleasure. Especially because I suppose, like so many people born and raised in this region, I've got a difficult relationship to it, which was perhaps exactly the reason that I came back to it. I mean, it took quite some effort to make a case, you know, when I did my studies and my doctoral research, to explain to, you know, fellow British social anthropologists that I wouldn't go to faraway places, former colonies, all these things that I felt very uneasy about. But I wanted to go back to a place that I came from, but that I still didn't quite fully understand. So it was, you know, I sometimes think about it in, you know, as a reverse anthropological work. Instead of going far from home, I sort of went home from far, without working precisely on myself, because I didn't feel like I fit into that tradition. I was really interested in understanding historically, like I said, a generation of cultural producers, of dramaturgs, of thinkers, of teachers. I mention teachers, by the way, so often because the German theater tradition is partly fascinating, I think, because it has institutionalized two public roles in theaters, which is the theater pedagogue and the dramaturg. We can talk about that later. And So to go back to the Ruhrgebiet, for me, was an attempt to look at the way in which this generation of critical thinkers who, you know, were born towards the end of the Second World War, who engaged with German traditions of military, industrial, institutions and companies that were so strong in the Ruhr Valley. Of course, we think about ThyssenKrupp and others, and all the coal mining that obviously was already under Prussia, and then during World War II, a very important industrial empire and region for Germany. I was very interested in how, you know, critical artists and thinkers and philosophers fit into this region, because it just didn't seem to me to be, the most obvious place to study, I suppose, cultural production at a professionalized level. But of course, as you can imagine, the Ruhr Valley is also fascinating because it produced over time this assemblage, this strange body without organs, you know, of over 51 cities, of rivers, of highways. The so-called A40 highway is right next to the Theater an der Ruhr. And in fact, it's kind of like its logo, designed by the stage designer, is a little pun on the fact that, you know, it's actually an arrow that turns left, but it looks like a highway sign. And obviously, turning left on a highway is quite a difficult undertaking. And this A40, you know, is such a quintessential example of the difficulty of this area. Cities that you would think could be connected, and yet at the same time are just shot through with these concrete highways that full of traffic jams. It takes you ages to go from A to B. So there is a theoretical connectivity, and there is a strange sense of, you know, I'm not sure if I'm abusing Benedict Anderson now, but of an imagined community. In fact, Josef Roth used this phrase of the der Rauch, der die Städte verbindet, so the smoke that kind of connects, the fog that connects the cities, as a common identity. I remember my father talking to me about, you know, being a child in the 50s and swimming into the Rhine and clinging onto these coal-carrying boats, or just blowing your nose and just essentially having a black piece of a paper in front of you. So anyway, there are so many stories to tell about this region that to me all were about devastation and decadence and industrial labor. And it was interesting to me how this region had transformed itself. And part of this story, so of course for me, had to do with the so-called IBA, the Internationale Bauausstellung, or the International Building Exhibition, which was a very early and I think pioneering attempt at regenerating open sewage canals and turning them into just, you know, recreational areas, cleaning rivers and reforesting, replanting plants, turning old industrial sites into museums and so on, something that we've seen all around the world and for which, of course, cities like Detroit and Marseille are examples. But it just hit me in particular because in 2010, when I did some preliminary research on the Ruhr Valley, it was elected as the European Capital of Culture, with Essen, one of the cities right there, at its center. And it was just so full of contradictions, because really what it showed was that what the creative industries and politicians had in mind was to create a sort of clean utopian future that would draw on the charming appeal of these dirty workers, you know, and their sort of quite literally othered bodies, their dirty bodies from the mines, but also their brown, othered, ethnicized bodies. But with, you know, it wanted that image, it wanted that sort of charm, that dynamic, that friction, but without these people. So a lot of the creative industries that had been built in this region are really quite literally greenwashed, whitewashed industries. And the Theater an der Ruhr sits again diagonally and sort of at odds with this tradition. Yeah, I'll stop there because I could talk to you all day about the contradiction, the difficulties of the Ruhr Valley.
You mentioned these roles of pedagogue and dramaturg at the German theater companies. Could you maybe also talk more about German theater more broadly, and then also these ethnographic concepts that you bring in the book of Kultur, Bildung, and Haltung.
Yes, with pleasure, because this was, I suppose, the starting point for my research. I think it might have been my supervisor, maybe it was someone else who said to me that, you know, every good anthropological endeavor or project begins with something you don't understand, you know, with a certain, I would say, curiosity or awe or fascination, but something that bugs you. This was the great Barbara Bodenholm said this to me, actually, as a small shout out to one of my first academic mentors and supervisors. But anyway, German theater to me seemed something both so deeply familiar as somebody, you know, the son of two high school teachers who, of course, were fascinated with theater and took me there quite often. So I felt like I knew this tradition. Many of my friends did internships, so-called Hospitanzen, in these theaters. They were essentially, for me, when I grew up, you know, just nice places to hang out, watch a play, talk with friends who were interested in literature and so on. But at the same time, there was something that I didn't quite fully understand, you know, especially being abroad. It just struck me that it's so fascinating how a country has such a broad and yet fragmented and often, however strangely in terms of its intellectual trajectories, coherent system of public theaters. And so what I began working on was to try and understand how, for instance, these theaters are funded, how they came about. And the first thing that strikes you, you know, perhaps as a non-German who's not familiar with this tradition, is that 80% of the funding for German public theaters, city theaters, comes from the cities themselves. This is, of course, then you realize related to, you know, its turbulent history throughout the 20th century. And you begin to understand that economic patronage, which was something that I was interested in at the beginning, cultural policies, are very much related to an attempt of dealing with, you know, federalization, which is a political gesture. The idea of spreading out the control over culture is a direct response to the Gleichschaltung during the Third Reich. And yet, of course, and this is interesting, it relates much further back to a time in which Germany was a fragmented, assemblage of different fiefdoms and regions in which every small area had its own courtly theater, had its own city theater. I mean, it's often fascinating reading, you know, stories of how Schiller escaped from Mannheim somewhere else, you know, and would literally find himself persecuted in one part and 100 miles further was found refuge. And this is, of course, the much longer prehistory to this fragmentation and this decentralization and federalization of German theater. This is something that fascinated me, and I tried to understand it because it meant that, of course, every theater in every small region had at least the possibility of developing a certain more particular relationship with its locality. And often this was enacted through people like theater pedagogues. I remember that the theater pedagogue of the Theater an der Ruhr often came to my classes, my German classes when I was studying in high school. And he would be this sort of interesting social figure in a city connecting students with a public cultural institution. Not as the word might suggest, to explain away theater and, you know, dumb it down, but really just to create connections, to be this sort of connecting node, you know, this socius in A&T terms. So this, again, was something that fascinated me. And then I was fascinated by the fact that whenever I try to explain the, I suppose, deep reflexivity on German culture, German traditions, German literature, to friends of mine in the UK, that they were struck by this, you could say, heaviness or the you know, the deepness or perhaps just the, I suppose the focus on theory and history and in these theaters. And I found myself trying to understand how it came about that German public theatres and the system of German public theatres I was interested in became such a political forum. Why the German state was so interested in investing in maintaining this federal tradition, what the historic reasons are for the particular types of directing that you see all across Germany, the particular development of a post-traumatic logic that wouldn't adhere to particular playwrights but actually bring in different theories, secondary literature, the fact that the history of the dramaturg, about which Mary Lackhurst wrote so beautifully, is also the tradition of something that I came to think about as a third position, as a sort of I wouldn't say another normative instance within these public theater traditions, but as somebody who would keep in check what takes place on stage, as this sort of philosopher who sits on the just at some remove from what's going on and actually checks that things are critical enough, that things are being thought through, this sort of in-house philosopher. Yeah, so these are some of the things that fascinated me and got me to try to understand this tradition for a broader audience.
In the book, you write about art as an ethical practice. What does it mean for theater to be an ethical practice?
So there are several levels to this. Of course, pragmatically speaking, any field in which people ask themselves, perhaps in more intense ways than normal, how to behave, what good practice is, what bad practice is, what it means to be a good cook, what it means to be a good teacher, those are ethical fields, and the practice of reflecting on it is an ethical practice. Not to be confused with a moral practice. I'm making a very deliberate distinction here that has been made by a field that was very important to me that developed around the time I was conceiving this book, which is the anthropology of ethics, in which many people like James Laidlaw, James Fobian, and others, Vina Das and so on, were drawing on traditions from Nietzsche to Foucault to try and distinguish normative moralities from an ethical engagement with these norms. So the way in which people, I suppose, relate to norms, the way in which they develop a particular conduct, a very important word for me in this book, around the norms, the way in which they grapple with existing ideas of good and bad, the way in which they might develop their own ones, or privately, or as lay practitioners, and so on. And you can imagine that this was obviously a very important field of study for scholars interested in religion, for instance. And this was a very important field of study for philosophers and anthropologists interested in how people do this in their ordinary lives. So the whole idea of an ordinary ethics became quite relevant to a lot of scholars. But for me, reading a lot of this literature and being very fascinated by it and finding it just an incredibly important way to think about structures and norms and freedom and agency. That's why I mentioned books like, one of my favorite books of all time, Lila Abu Nogor's Veiled Sentiments, about these Bedouin women who are using an existing respected tradition of oral poetry to weave in their own engagements and criticism of this tradition, but in a way that could not be criticized because they're using and drawing on this respected tradition. So I was very interested in questions of, how traditions of practice are encouraging people to think about themselves and how they could become otherwise. And it struck me when reading all of these books that very little was said about the arts in general. Very little was said about theater more specifically. There are, of course, notable examples. And almost nothing, strangely, within anthropology, at least, and I'm talking here both about British social anthropology, French ethnology, German Volkskunde, and so on, was said about German theater. And this struck me because as a German, and this is, I suppose, where I drew on that tradition, knowing it and growing up with it and having internalized it so much, theater, especially in the German context, especially modern theater, was, as Schiller said, really a laboratory, eine moralische Anstalt. It was the place in which both national and imperial norms about citizenship, freedom, education, nationhood, and so on were debated and enacted. Many playwrights, including Schiller, said, you know, Germany would not become one nation if it didn't have its theaters. Benedict Anderson, Philip Ter, and others have written extensively about theaters as these stages in which public ideas, emotions, norms, and so on become discussed. But what was lacking for me was a precise investigation of how actors and actresses, directors, dramaturgs, audiences were working with this on a day-to-day basis. Because different from lay performers or from spontaneous performances in the street or from the idea of, you know, this performance studies a consequence of the generalization of dramaturgical metaphors to social life in general, there are people in professional theaters and in performance settings that spend day in, day out, not just from 9 to 5 and not just from Monday to Friday, working on themselves, on their bodies, on their thoughts, on literature, on ways of behaving. And more than that, they are working on themselves by way of working on what it means to be someone else. So I felt that very different from a lot of approaches that have been developed in the anthropology of ethics, this kind of theater that I was interested in, partly because of its institutional setup, but also because of the cultural history of this tradition, was actually a field, a theatrical field in the sense of Tracy Davis, that is to say, a field slightly removed from the everyday, set aside. You know, you don't just randomly walk into a rehearsal as you're doing grocery shopping. It's a specific setting. It is theatrical in the sense that it's set aside from reality. This is Tracy Davis's way of phrasing this. And yet at the same time, it is a daily practice for a lot of people. And so I use this idea of the extraordinary field in this book, you know, not just to say it's amazing, but really in this other sense of it's something that is set aside that goes beyond the ordinary. And that is a space in which ethical questions are really at heart and, interestingly, are somewhat doubly present, like I said, because you're constantly, as an actor, dealing, even if you're impersonating yourself, you're constantly dealing with at least two people, yourself, a character, yourself, the way which you're seen, audiences. It's constantly a relational practice. And then, of course, there is the long tradition of German Bildung, but maybe I could say a word about that in a different response.
No, I think actually maybe now is the perfect time to talk about Bildung.
Yes, great. Well, like I said, the particular institutional setup of the Theater an der Ruhr and of public theaters already lend itself to studying, I suppose, the, you know, recent practices from Mises, you know, the idea that you could be on stage and act something out, act out something with others, not just playing as if you're acting out a particular life or character or attitude, but you're actually doing so at that very moment. This is, I think, one of the important aspects of theater, you know, that I'm trying to deal with in this book. That yes, while you could say that me putting on a Shakespeare play and taking on a particular character, you know, playing Othello, yes, that is a character from a book. That's the character from a play. But at the same time, I exist as a human body in this very moment, and I'm being watched, and I've rehearsed this role. I've rehearsed engaging with the complexities and the difficulties of that character for several months. I've been watched in a normative setting of a rehearsal. I've been told what in this case would be the right way to enact this emotion, the right way to deal with these things. So all of these are micro moments of reflection on ethics, but, and this is the key point where the concept of Bildung comes on, in the context of an aesthetic experience, in the context of the production of art, and this relationship between artistic production, the experience of art, the witnessing of it, but also the production of it, and the questions that I refer to as ethical questions, which is, how do I relate to the morals of a state? How do I relate to the morals of my class, of my upbringing, of my cultural context? And I mean this in the sense of, you know, in the context of my family, my friends, my community, and so on. And of course, in the history of Germany also, in relationship to a political ideology, the East, the West. I mean, we mustn't forget that, of course, there is a hugely interesting corpus of literature and original documents, you know, from theater in the GDR and the role that Heiner Müller and Bertolt Brecht and others have played in, I suppose, engagement with politics through theater, or differently put, the engagement with morals and ethics through aesthetics. And so it's for that reason also that I speak of theater as an ethico-aesthetic tradition. And I mean this really as a heuristic, as a term that we could use as scholars, because I'm not just interested in this large tradition, this large ethico-aesthetic tradition, this longer historic tradition, but also very specifically, an institution can become a tradition once it maintains practices of reflection on itself. This is why I draw on Alistair McIntyre in this book so much, because in his book After Virtue and that trilogy that followed, he engaged with these questions. But again, to come specifically to these terms, I mean, the title of the book, State of the Arts, is a reference to, I suppose, in the first instance, the Prussian Humboldtian institutionalization of this idea that we can reflect on ourselves, we can work on ourselves as citizens, as human beings, through engagement with art. Art not as entertainment, but also art as, especially theater in this case, as perhaps the most socially complex form of art, as a form of art that, as the theater critic Eric Bentley said, is fundamentally about one person impersonating another, being watched by a third. So it's obviously a specific social context and practice that lends itself to dealing with ethical and moral questions, because we're already in a social human context. And so this Prussian idea of, or especially this Humboldtian idea of Bildung, of, I suppose you could say, self-formation, fascinated me because it's both an inward-looking, I suppose you could say, not individual, but subjective practice. It's something which you're supposed to do by yourself, but it's also an outward-oriented practice. So Bildung was also, you know, a state practice. It's about education more generally, and it's about how you relate to others, how you form a community. So it's a fascinating concept to me, and it's especially fascinating because it explains to some extent the very idiosyncratic way in which modern Germany conceptualized its patronage for the arts and its patronage for theater. And it's for that reason that I draw on this idea of the Kulturstaat, or the state of the arts, for this book. And so Kultur and Bildung, of course, in that sense are related, but there is, again, another, you know, strand to this tradition that fascinated me and that I draw on this book a little bit, but that could be much more expanded upon, which is the long and difficult heritage of the German conception of Kultur as an inward-oriented, deeply conservative practice that creates the possibilities for discrimination, relativism, and fragmentation. I often think about, you know, Thomas Mann's Listen Germany radio broadcasts of Germans from the 40s onwards that he did for the BBC, and I draw all these a little bit in this book, in which he was analyzing the, you know, the dangers and the possibilities of a romantic understanding of German culture as something that would somehow allow for a sense of superiority. So that there are difficult elements to this notion of Kultur as well, that I think are quite fascinating. And, you know, few anthropologists, strangely, have picked up on this, except perhaps, for instance, you know, Louis Dumont and others. But it's very interesting to see this in relationship, I think, to such an institutionalized tradition such as theater. And the last term I think that I should maybe say a word on, because it's so central both to these traditions as well as to theater in particular, is that of Haltung. So Haltung is an interesting German word, because it combines a lot of the elements of Bildung. It combines both physical comportment, it combines an emotional attitude, a political perspective, an ethical conduct. It brings all of these together, and it was for that reason that Bertolt Brecht was so interested in this relationship between gesture or gestus and Haltung, the way in which an actor or an actress on stage would actually show or relate to a particular political attitude, Haltung of the characters they play, but also bring in their own. So for him, it was an important concept. But besides that, I realized that in the context of the Theater Nouveau and in my work with them, this idea of the Haltung, that your Haltung, it just came up again and again, and it meant something a little bit different. It wasn't a normative idea of, you know, you should have this Haltung or that Haltung. But it was actually, and that's why I speak about it so much as the, you know, as the conduct of conduct in this book, it was a practice that was about building a competency, a capacity to be otherwise. So Haltung in this case was really something that you would try and rehearse as an actor, as an actress. You would rehearse to be able to relate to other types of attitudes and postures. And it was this idea of Haltung that I thought was particularly fascinating, because it brought together, you know, the practical and the reasoned.
I love this book. My only regret is that I didn't get to read it before finishing my PhD. It was so interesting to read. And you mentioned two books that maybe listeners should also check out, which of course is Lila Abu Nurhut's Veiled Sentiments, which is one of my favorite books as well. And I learned about Louis Dumont's German ideology in your introduction, I think. And so that was also super interesting. You write so wonderfully. Jonas, I've complimented your writing before, but you write so wonderfully. It's so exciting to read. I learned so much. I've lived in Germany for 8 years. I learned so much in this book. It's so wonderful. I have one final question, which is a tradition on the New Books Network, and that is to ask, what are you working on now?
Well, first of all, Adam, thank you so much. It's incredibly humbling that you say this, because this book has been in the making for quite some time, and it is dedicated to my father, who passed away as I was writing this, and it's dedicated also to this field of, you know, people who became not just informants, but interlocutors, collaborators, mentors, and friends. So that's why I'm very happy you say this, because to me it's a testament to this field. I am right now writing a book that I have actually been working on since 2016. Brexit year, when I left the UK and started working at the Humboldt University with Sharon McDonald first, and then since 2020 with Marcus Wessling in this ERC project, Meine Universalität, that you mentioned. And this is a book that has the working title Beyond the Universal Machine, Art and Anthropology After the Museum of World. And it is a book that serves also as my habilitation, as you mentioned at the beginning. But it's a book that draws on fieldwork I've been doing for a number of years in Berlin, specifically around the Humboldt Forum and the Berliner Schloss and the Ethnological Museum. But that works or reflects especially what curators in this field, independent critical curators, have thought and done and responded to the rebuilding of a neo-universal, post-universal museum. And so this book, which I'm hopefully finishing this year, is trying to make some proposals for how we can think beyond the universal machine without abandoning an idea that, you know, there can be a common we.
And hopefully you'll be on for that book as well.
I hope so too. Thank you so much, Adam. It was beautiful talking to you.
The book is State of the Arts, published in 2023 with Cambridge University Press. Dr. Jonas Tinius, thank you again for joining me today.
Thank you.